from WBUR Boston, I'm Tom Asbrook, and this is On Point. In the long years of the Cold War, capitalism was a fortress and a battle cry. Margaret Thatcher stood high on those ramparts. Then the walls came down. Capitalism won and morphed and changed, as it always has. A new generation of thinkers is looking afresh at capitalism, where it's been, what it's become. This hour, On Point, we're taking a big second look at capitalism. You can join us on air or online. How's it worked? How's it working? What do you see happening with capitalism? Join us anytime digitally at onpointradio.org or on Twitter and Facebook at On Point Radio. The conversation never ends. Across the country, there's a new batch of thinking on capitalism. It's in the streets with Occupy. It's in boardrooms and corporate retreats. And it's in campus realms. Two of the brightest lights there are with us today. From New York, Julia Ott, professor in the history of capitalism at the New School. She's part of a new generation of scholars re-examining capitalism. In her case, the financial side in particular. She's author of When Wall Street Met Main Street. Julia Ott, welcome to On Point.
Thank you so much for having me.
It's great to have you. Also with us from Ithaca, New York, is Lewis Hyman, professor in labor relations, law, and history at Cornell. He looks at the intersection of government and the market. His most recent book is Borrow, The American Way of Debt. Lewis Hyman, thank you for being here.
Great to be here, Tom. Thanks.
So aren't you guys superstars all of a sudden? The history of capitalism is back as a subject. It's on page one of the New York Times. And there you are right in the middle of it. But I've got to tell you, I mean, maybe this just happened, maybe it didn't. It certainly seems timely. We get so many questions here from our listeners about how capitalism is working these days and what it has become. Julia Ott, you say very clearly that it's never been one thing forever. Capitalism is always changing and changing.
Absolutely. And, you know, as historians who identify with this label, history of capitalism, we're very interested in teasing out those different varieties of capitalism across geographic regions and across, especially across time. So we can, you know, think about capitalism in some sort of loose definition, you know, private property, maybe there's some wage labor in there, and it's a system in which economic activity involves the accumulation of capital. It involves the accumulation of the means of production. But, you know, where does owning people, you know, racialized chattel slavery in the United States, individuals who are capital and owned by other people, how does that fit into capitalism? How does the welfare state and greater or lesser degrees of government intervention and government regulation, what's the role of organized labor and how does state policy facilitates labor's voice at the table? These are all very different, look very different at different historical moments and in different national contexts, and they produce very different social outcomes. So that is something that as historians of capitalism, we really want to try to understand.
Lewis, why is capitalism back as a subject? Why is a really a younger generation in scholarly terms, yourself, Julia, others, picking this up as a subject for close inquiry? What sort of set it free again to be reconsidered?
Well, I think the first thing to notice is that there's lots of people of older generations who have been interested in these things for a long time. I mean, we think about what is capitalism. It's about finance, it's about work, it's about consumption. And a lot of people have been studying this, but it wasn't always at the center of the stories, taking what is capitalism as the problem to be explained rather than just the assumed backstory for all kinds of, you know, basically our lives. We live in capitalism. So I think for people in the last 10 years or so, we've been trying to say, I think it gets back to what you said in the introduction about the end of the Cold War, that, you know, now that we don't have capitalism or communism, we can open up this conversation and say, all right, well, how has capitalism changed over time? And certainly in the last, obviously since the Great Recession, we have started to find an audience with people. People are starting to question capitalism. All the explanations they've been given for how the world ought to work has failed. People do not believe that, you know, the efficient market hypothesis explains everything. And I think that what we're trying to do is really just sort of give the story that explains, well, what did change over time? Why has capitalism worked here and not worked there? What is its upsides and downsides? And, you know, how should we think about it going forward?
It's refreshing to have it outside that Cold War kind of prison where it was just this or that. You're for us or you're against us. It must give you more freedom, even as scholars, Lewis, to look around.
Absolutely. And, you know, it's an amazing thing to teach with students. You know, they come from across the political spectrum. You have people who want to go be investment bankers. You have those people who want to go to Occupy. And everyone wants to understand, well, what does it mean to have a capitalist society? What does it mean for all those important issues about inequality, about growth, you know, things that are the deepest questions we're asking ourselves in our society about capitalism and democracy and what is the future for it?
Let's get some historical perspective right in here. We'll start with Calvin Coolidge. Here he is, August 1924. This is he was filmed delivering a speech at the White House about the cost of government, explaining here why he, Calvin Coolidge, is in favor of small government, free enterprise.
I want the people of America to be able to work less for the government and more for themselves. I want them to have the rewards of their own industry. This is the chief meaning of freedom.
The chief meaning of freedom. Julia, we've got lots of urgent questions from our listeners about how it's working today. Mm-hmm. But to look at that, I wish you'd just, you and Lewis, but start yourself. Begin to run us through the sort of big chapters of capitalism. You describe how it has changed and changed quite markedly over time. What people's expectations were, how they understood it, what the capital at the heart of it was. I don't know. Take us back. Start where you will, somewhere in the 19th century, and just chunk us briskly through some of these big chapters so we can come up to date.
Well, let's see. If we begin with the beginning, would you like care for us to begin with the beginning of the 19th century, sort
okay,
of nation's
sure.
founding?
Anywhere, dive in anywhere where it makes sense. But let's run through some of these chapters.
Right. Okay. So, you know, maybe Lewis and I can sort of bounce back and forth
Great.
Between each other. So, you know, you begin the 19th century, the new nation is a political culture that is grounded in the belief that broad-based ownership of the means of production, namely land, is really the key economic attribute that's required for democracy to function effectively.
Now, Jeffersonian
of course,
idea.
The Jeffersonian mm-hmm. ideal. And, of course, these, you know, property-owning citizens are men with who run the gamut from children and indentured servitudes and slaves and their wives as well, mm-hmm. Who are all dispossessed of the vote, but you know don't have the vote because they don't have property because they don't have the vote. There are folks like Alexander Hamilton and the Whigs who would like to see a more contained economic system and the development of American industry through promotion, state regulations and state policies to promote the industrialization or the development of American industry and high tariff rates. But these guys are kind of in a minority in comparison to what most Americans want. Again, going back to that Jeffersonian ideal.
Lots of angles there, but broad-based ownership of means of production, i.e. land, that was possible on this new continent where they're willing to dispossess people who are sitting there, but it made that possible,
right.
And that was an important at the heart of how they looked at capitalism. Lewis, within that, as Julia mentioned earlier, slavery is a big piece. That was a big chunk of capital in a big part of this country, but there was land for many at the same time, means of production, widespread.
Absolutely. And, you know, I think the question itself is terrifying to us as historians. We talk about this for months at a time in classes. You know, when we teach history of capitalism, it takes months to answer that question. Well, what is the history of capitalism? But I think broadly speaking that the 19th century, it was an economy of agriculture. Right. This is the primary question. And you can see it in the origins of how we go from an agricultural economy to a manufacturing economy, beginning in really the late 19th century, when you start to see large organized labor unions as well as large organized businesses. You see the emergence of the first big corporations and the way those form to create a new kind of oligopolic or monopoly capitalism that goes into the early 20th century. And then in the late 20th century, you see a shift from this sort of stable, big kinds of corporations towards more what are called lean corporations without organized labor, with a new reorientation to the market. And so thinking about that big sweep, you know, from agriculture to manufacturing, from small business to big business, from owning your own farm or small business or artisanal shop in the 19th century to what does it mean to work for a corporation, work for a wage, as so many of us do today? These are the kinds of questions. And so you can see just in the housing crisis, what is it, the meaning of the home, that we go from homesteads, which are actually businesses in the 19th century, mm-hmm. to homes in the 20th century that actually produce nothing but still have this cultural feeling of independence. So there's a lot of ways we can talk about
it. And big waves coming in here, debt, which was everybody was trying to avoid early on but became central to the way our economy worked in the late 20th century. Finance, which, Julia, you write of what – you know, it was widely held in very low regard, Wall Street in the 19th century. By the end of the 20th, Wall Street's health is seen as a barometer for the nation's capitalist economic health.
That's right. Yeah, and I'm glad that you reminded us to keep finance in the picture. I mean, that 19th century agrarian-based economy was actually a context for a tremendous amount of financial innovation from the Chicago Board of Trade to, you know, very innovative financial techniques being developed by planters, as the work of Ed Baptist shows. But finance moves to the center of American capital in the 20th century, and now at the end of the beginning of the 21st century, we live in a financialized economy in which the financial sector is really the driving force.
I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. Talking about a big second look at capitalism underway right now this hour. A new generation of thinkers asking how it's worked, how it hasn't, how it's changed, where we're headed. People have been thinking and talking about this for a long time, but free of the Cold War and with the experience of the, near crash, Great Recession right behind us here, it's getting a really fresh look these days. The assertion, Margaret Thatcher is very much in the news this week. The assertion back in her heyday was, this is the way that works. And she and Ronald Reagan helped bring it back in a big way, pushed the move to strip away a lot of regulation, free things up. Here she is, she talked to Ronald Reagan and members of the Congress. This was in 1985. She was talking about her efforts to recover the spirit of enterprise. She talked about the sale of British Telecom. It was one of her successes. It was one of her most high-profile acts of privatization of a once state-run company. Here she is talking with the U.S. Congress.
Members of Congress, that is what capitalism is. A system which brings wealth to the many and not just to the few.
And boy, did that get a lot of applause in the Reagan 1980s. Fast forward, November 2008, Congress again. Here's Democratic Congressman Gary Ackerman of New York mocking the three automaker CEOs of Ford, Chrysler, and General Motors who testified before Congress about everything we all know that went on with the automakers after the crash. And they had arrived using corporate jets, private corporate jets, to travel to Washington to argue for a bailout.
There's a delicious irony in seeing private luxury jets flying in to Washington, D.C., and people coming off of them with tin cups in their hand, saying that they're going to be trimming down and streamlining their businesses. It's almost like seeing a guy show up at the soup kitchen in high hat and tuxedo.
And we all watched as a new generation of thinkers really giving a workout to capitalism here. And a big appetite in this country to hear it. Julia Ott is with us this hour from the New School. She's author of When Wall Street Met Main Street, joins us from New York. Lewis Hyman is here, professor at Cornell University, author of Borrow, The American Way of Debt, and Debtor Nation, The History of America in Red Ink. You can read excerpts from each at our website, onpointradio.org. Lewis, Julia, there's lots of ways we can come at this. Our listeners have lots of questions, and I think they'll help us here. Here's one. Creaker says, I think capitalism went through a small golden period after World War II where it embraced sizable groups of people and created a relatively large middle class. A listener writes, prior to that, capitalism through the ages largely provided great benefits to a few through the exploitation of the rest. We are returning to that norm. Lewis, what do you say to that observation?
Well, I think that that is a very good observation. You know, historians like to call the post-war the golden age of capitalism. And I think this is why it's so important to study its history, because this is the story we absolutely need to get right. If we're going to create policies that can figure out how to harness the tremendous energy of capitalism, its growth. And because capitalism is an amoral system that produces growth, but it also produces inequality. And what happened in the post-war was that there were a set of policies in place that Reagan and Thatcher were responding to on a very personal level that actually were turning all that tremendous energy of capitalism into a broad-based, well-balanced prosperity. And it's those kinds of policies that we created in the 30s and 40s, and then we somehow forgot by the time we got to the 70s. So when we have the stagflation and going off into the Bretton Woods system, instead of doubling down on the kinds of policies that produced that post-war prosperity, we moved away from them. We decided that we would instead embrace turbulence and instability, and we can see the results of that today.
But, Julia, you know very well that there are ardent supporters of capitalism who say, no, that was stifling capitalism. That was Ronald Reagan's line, the sort of Ayn Rand line as well, saying we've got to take these inhibitions off, get back to something more free to let it really run. So who's right, or is anyone right? Is capitalism coming all these flavors? You know, when Barack Obama goes toward policies like that today, it's called straight up socialist by his opponents, Julia.
I would say that the question is not whether or not, you know, there are benefits, but rather who benefits. And to try to understand that not only this golden age of post-war, Keynesian-inspired capitalism, that was constructed by politics, by policy, but so were the what we call, quote-unquote, more laissez-faire periods that have preceded and succeeded it. In terms, you know, Lewis and I have done some work. We have a piece that's coming out in the New Labor Forum. We do find actually that golden age of post-war Keynesian economic policy produced higher rates of growth and lower unemployment than the Reagan-Thatcher era. You would find that if you looked at the British data too. Of course, critics would say, well, you're looking at a completely different world. In one case, you've got a globalized economy, the more recent period, the economy's subject to global economic competition in a way that the mid-century U.S. economy was not. So you really can't rerun the experiment at controlling for all factors. But there's certainly a lot to debate there, I think.
Let's go to Michael calling from outside the U.S. borders. Why not? Montreal, Canada. Michael, thanks for calling. You are on the air.
Hi, Tom. Thanks for taking my call. Mm-hmm. I was wondering what your guests thought of this definition of capitalism, since the idea is to understand what it is that's evolving, what it has evolved to, and what it's become. Raw capitalism would be the idea that you have the right to use and acquire capital as you see fit. And enlightened capitalism, what maybe we're evolving to, is the idea that people have a right to capital.
Two very different definitions. Lewis, what do you say?
Well, I think the important thing when doing the history of capitalism is very simply, you know, show me the money. How does the money move, right? How does the money move in the economy, and how does that change the way in which we work and consume and live? And I think it's less important to worry about definitions, at least for me, than it is to worry about actually understanding, getting inside firms, getting inside institutions, and see how they work. So let's not worry about defining everything and thinking about abstract theories of what things ought to be. And this is what historians do. We get inside the archive. We see how things actually operated on the ground, not always as we assume they do.
But let's take the impulse that Michael puts on the table there, because he's asserting a kind of evolutionary path here from use and acquire as you see fit, the right to do that, to the right to capital. Those are quite different. We've got many other commenters online who don't see that evolutionary trend, certainly don't see a right to capital emerging. We had a period of social welfare being, you know, sewn in here very prominently in the mid-20th century. But we've got actually more inequality emerging, Julia.
Well, I'm not exactly clear what the caller means by a right to capital, but I'll interpret that as meaning the notion that every individual has a right in some sense to own, you know, assets.
Own a piece of the pie.
The policy paradigm of the last 40 years and the political beliefs that undergird it certainly embraced that notion. And we did for a time see rising incidences. I mean, it began in the post-war period, but, you know, really even more accelerated in the last 40 years, a rising instance of home ownership and stock ownership, but also a trend of stagnant wages and a colossal, really radical uptick in the incidence of consumer debt. So, you know, people have, Americans have, more Americans have a stake in that sense, but they're heavily indebted in that stake and, as we've seen, perhaps even underwater for their stake. You know, so I think policymakers and pundits have identified that as a defining feature and a defining goal of American capitalism, and policies in the last 40 years have tried to shift to support that. But without the support of good wages and good jobs, you know, owning financial assets but being heavily indebted in order to acquire them doesn't really provide people with a meaningful stake in it or a meaningful slice of the pie, in my opinion.
Which may be where we stand right now. David in Hartford, Connecticut. David, thanks for calling. You're on the air.
Hi, Tom. Thanks Hi. For this important discussion.
Mm-hmm.
My comment is that I think it would be helpful both looking backwards but also especially looking forwards and even teaching our children in schools to reframe the study of capitalism is really why does a particular people choose a particular economic system, a particular governmental system? Because the way I see capitalism is, you know, it's done very well with maximizing human, individual human strengths, such as industriousness, creativity, imagination, energy and drive,
okay.
But it's done relatively poorly over the long haul is dealing with human weaknesses of greed, unfairness, selfishness, dishonesty. And I think if people, if we could find the right balance and teach our children the right balance between what's the difference between obtaining capital and investing it into my idea versus obtaining capital, investing it into my idea, but also destroying these other people over here simply because I can.
David, you put it wonderfully. Let me take it straight to Lewis Hyman. I'm sure, Lewis, many people will listen to that and with a lot of thoughts. I mean, we see how capitalism is plowed into the environment in many ways. It can certainly plow into equitable society and make it bring on a lot of inequity. On the other hand, there is all that raw power in it that has, as David says, maximized a lot of individual potential here, and through that, a lot of national wealth. What about this balance and the notion that, you know, ethics is always kind of running alongside trying to get on the bandwagon, but not quite?
Yeah, I think that he gets right to the core of the question. You know, what ought capitalism do for us? You know, how can we make it work for us and not just work us over? Right. I think that in terms of thinking about it, we need to understand that capitalism is the permanent revolution. It's the greatest engine of growth in human history. It's the most important thing that's happened, and one might argue, in the last few thousand years. And I think that it can't be everything for everyone. Right. That's why we have political and political economy, right? Figuring out how to channel that energy. And there's a lot of ways that historians have shown how to do this. You know, we think of this post-war period, for instance, as a period of Keynesianism, but it was also a time when the new, and this is where historians come into play, showing the sort of right aspects, not the left aspects, of the New Deal in terms of certain kinds of institutions like, you know, Fannie Mae and Freddie, you know, obviously now on hard times, but also things like the Defense Plant Corporation that was run not by, you know, left-wing eggheads and academics, but by, you know, sober-minded corporate leaders who turned all this private capital through the mechanism of the state into new industries like aerospace and everything like that. And so it's a way in which we need to figure out how we can use the engine of capitalism, private capital, for social ends. And it's not always about taking the money and redistributing it. It's also about creating incentives for capitalism so that we make that profit work for us, so that we make that happen for us.
Julie, you've got a lot of comments here that you can pick up on these if you would and take us where you like. But there's a lot of skepticism right now. Daphne writes, she says, it went from pro-America and pro-worker to anti-America, anti-worker, turning America into feudalism and oligarchy. Lots of comments along those lines. Mike writes, you have to talk about the difference between capitalism and corporatism. Lucas says, and I'm not sure if he's coming from a free market angle or another angle here, says, the age of capitalism is coming to an end and the age of the state is beginning. Pick up on those if you'd be kind enough, Julia.
I would love to. I just did want to add one thing after Lewis's mm-hmm. comment is, you know, what historians of capitalism in this generation, I think, try to do, and we're not, you know, we're drawing on an older tradition, is to also recognize the fact that capitalism is, as has been, one of the greatest, not, I'm not trying to say the greatest, but one of the greatest, certainly, engines of human exploitation and suffering, as much as it's been a benefit to human
yes.
existence. Right? So what we see, what, you know, just to kind of mm-hmm. echo Lewis's comments, the whole mission of the history of capitalism is to sort of recover this historical variability in capitalism, to do an honest accounting of strengths and weakness, you know, plus minus, and then allow those historical examples to serve as a departure point for reconsidering or for considering the potential malleability of our contemporary capitalism, right?
Mm-hmm.
So then, you know, kind of going from there into the caller's comments, we live in this moment now where we see levels of inequality that we have not, both in terms of income and in terms of wealth, that we haven't seen since the Jazz Age. You know, low levels of economic mobility across generation, some of the worst, conditions for economic mobility in the industrialized nation exist in the United States. And I think it's, you know, historians of capitalism want to understand, yes, both get into the box of the firm and the box of the market to understand how these things are produced, but sort of understand also the intellectual and policy currents that make these things palatable, make these sorts of developments palatable for a time, or hide, you know, the costs, the consequences, and the suffering at least for a time, and try to come to terms with those aspects as well.
Lewis, do you feel more free as an academic to have this discussion? Does the whole academic community feel more free to have it now than during the Cold War times where this, oh, you can't talk about that, capitalism is sacred? are we at a point where we can say, well, let's just look at this very calmly and try and figure out how to make it work better?
I think that they're too young to answer that question.
Yeah, I was in elementary school during the Cold War, but I think there certainly is the experience that you know, there is that we can ask these questions, and it doesn't have to be, you know, in lockstep with a certain kind of left-wing or right-wing ideology. And it really can just be like, well, let's see how it actually works on the ground. Look at the archive. But I think the question of choice is, and it's Manly Biddy, Julie is exactly right, that understanding, well, who has choice? What are the limits of action within capitalism? If capitalism is this, you know, system of investment and work and everything, well, how can we change that? And just asking the question, what is the history of capitalism, is a real sort of radical step versus thinking that capitalism is an always eternal thing.
Does that history suggest it's open to tweaking and change, or that it's just, you know, bluntly resistant?
Yes, you can tweak and change
open.
It. Yes, absolutely.
absolutely.
yes to both, maybe. I'm not sure. We'll see. This is On Point. We'll be right back. We're talking this hour about a big second look at capitalism underway right now across the country. A new generation of thinkers asking how it's worked, how it hasn't, how it's changed, where we're going. It's out there every day. Here's the bell on the New York Stock Exchange closing yesterday. Dow Jones Industrial Average, its second all-time high in a week. Julia Ott is with us this hour. She's a professor of history at the New School in New York, author of When Wall Street Met Main Street, The Quest for an Investor's Democracy. Lewis Hyman is with us from Cornell, author of Borrow, The American Way of Debt and Debtor Nation. Fall of 2011, thousands camped out in New York's financial district, Occupy Wall Street. Here's some of that sound. Okay, we remember that, and here's a little more, the 99%. Julia, Lewis, we have so much response online, digitally here. Let me just give you two sort of, maybe these are two ends of it, I'm not sure. On the one hand, you've got Jeff or Hefe saying, we live in a plutocracy spurred on by crony capitalism. What we have now is more akin to the late 19th century and the robber barons. There's one perspective. On the other hand, here's Eddie says, you know, please talk about the great need to permit easier startups for new entrepreneurship to lead America forward. You know, a free enterprise and productivity for more Americans. Our future depends on it. Capitalism is too restricted, too much regulation. What about those two poles, Lewis? Or are those the poles?
I mean, I think they're both part of the same desire, right? The desire to for greater feelings of autonomy within capitalism. And, you know, and for a lot of people, the feelings of security that comes with wage work is definitely an ambition and certainly something that in the past we've been able to provide. And the other side is the feeling of, well, I want to have that small business. In the 19th century would have been a farm, but today is a sense of a startup. And the kinds of policies, for instance, in my work, I write a lot about how the securitization of consumer debt has crowded out business debt among banks. And so it's very difficult for young entrepreneurs, unless they're in the tech field where they can sell off their equity, they can't even borrow, to actually get business debt to keep their businesses going. And not just sexy new enterprises, but just, you know, long-term profitable businesses.
You mean because banks can just take their capital and lend it to support everybody's credit card balance instead?
Exactly. Exactly. If you look at banks and you ask them, you know, it's not about government debt crowding out business debt. It's consumer debt because we balance the scales because there's huge markets created through government policy. Secondary markets and securitization of consumer debt that we don't have. We don't securitize business debt to the same extent, hardly at all.
This is not the way it was. I mean, this kind of debt was incredibly rare in earlier chapters of our capitalist history, Lewis.
It was at the margins of the economy. I mean, before World War I, this is consumer debt, and the way we use it now was the province of loan sharks, or it was very rare, and it's created a system of, this is what my work is all about, over the 20th century of how it moves from the margins of our economy to the center.
Who's pushing for that? Because that, I mean, on the one hand, consumers, I guess they wanted and maybe needed the float that came with those credit cards.
Sure.
But on the other hand, as you say, it may crowd out lending for innovative, forward-looking, growth-oriented entrepreneurship. So whose interest was that in? Who pushed that?
Well, it's a long story that would be too long for this. But the main question is about, you know, before basically 1970, consumer credit existed as a way to make it possible for manufacturing to realize profits. So GE Credit Corporation was a way to, it was like where GE careers went to die. But after the 60s and 70s, they realized that through various kinds of financial instruments, they can invest lots of money in consumer debt and make profits. And it's this possibility of investing in lending money to people that makes a difference. In the post-war period, the 1% paid the 99% good wages. And after 1970, the 1% simply lent them money through all this kinds of securitized consumer debt. And this inequality that we're talking about created a bubble at the top that demanded investment, but it's at that exact moment that we create all these debt instruments to be invested in, and that crowds out and fundamentally short-circuits the economy, because inequality can only be justified if it produces new kinds of investments in business that produce good jobs and growth.
I knew you could boil it down. I knew you could do it. Julia, take us to the heart of your... I mean, you focus on finance. You remind us that in the 19th century, Wall Street was considered, you know, very marginal, ethically very marginal. Well, so many questions there, but what's the significance of it having come to reside kind of at the heart of how we think about American capitalism, the barometer?
Right. Well, first, let me begin by reminding Lewis about one of his most insightful findings, which is that, you know, you, Tom, you asked the question, how does debt, who pushes this?
Mm-hmm.
And one of the things that Lewis talks about is that this willingness of Americans to get into these higher debt burdens is emerged in a particular historical context in which their wages were growing. So they sort of had this confidence, and this is both in the 1920s and then again, you know, comes back again in the 50s and 60s. We'll be able to pay it off. But that stops happening. That part of it stops happening in the 1970s. So it's not just a push. It's also a pull.
Mm-hmm.
Okay. So then in terms of your question that you just posed about the stock market and how does it move to the center of American life, the way in which people conceptualize of the economy and the way in which, you know, people interact and with mm-hmm. the capitalist system as not just as workers or owners of real businesses, but also as owners of financial assets.
Securities.
The book, yes, securities, right. So
funny
the book
word.
That the book that I've written looks at the first instance of mass investment in the beginning of the 20th century. And again, it's not, you know, it's pushed by corporate leaders and conservatives as a way to, you know, provide Americans with a stake in the political and economic system. The Americans that they're most concerned about are
that's a well-intentioned at some level. Give everybody a piece of this. But
right.
also not be the only Robert Barons alone at the center of the bullseye.
Right. But with no intention of sort of, you know, allowing them to influence corporate policy, you know, I mean, a broadly distribute base of share owners aren't going to mobilize and challenge management about the direction of the corporation.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, ideally, the intention is also that we can keep them from either joining labor unions or demanding regulation or nationalization of industry if they feel like they have this stake.
Mm-hmm.
So there are those conservatives that are pushing that ideal. But there is also in the book tries to chart this, there are also progressives who are part of that conversation who share the concerns about Americans' diminished access to the means of production in the real economy, and that stock ownership might be something that could replace that.
I mean, for a good while, it worked. You have plenty of current retirees.
Right.
I mean, some are in trouble, but others are sitting on nice nest eggs that grew up in mutual funds invested in those in that system.
Right, right. And in this earlier incidents, you know, lots of progressives who said that this would be a good thing and it's a reason for the government to intervene and regulate the financial markets rather than, you know, than being part of this sort of more conservative political agenda. So I think one of the things is that the fact that both progressive and conservative voices, both in the, you know, 19-teens and 20s, but then really all throughout the 20th century, have agreed that the stock market is a place where Americans should all have the opportunity to participate, and it shouldn't be the rarefied realm of the most elite members of the society, say, for example, the way that the hedge fund investments are
mm-hmm.
now, right? That the stock market shouldn't be like that is one of the reasons why it's, you know, moved to the fore in the ways that Americans have conceptualized the economy.
And yet there's all kinds of new ways of trading that not everybody has access to.
Absolutely. Absolutely.
I want to get Jay in here from Chino Valley, Arizona. Jay, thanks for calling. You're on the air.
Hi, Tom. Thanks.
Hi. Yeah.
I'm wondering if there's any historical precedent for capitalism co-opting religion to the point where social conservative leaders can position questioning capitalism as anti-Christian, and middle-class social conservatives are so willing to vote against their own economic interests. And I would like to take my answer off the air.
We'll pick it up, Jay. Thank you. Lewis, what do you say to that?
Well, I really wish our colleague Bethany Morton were here.
Yes.
She specializes in these kinds of issues. This is exactly what I think are the interesting questions. You know, what are the connections between capitalism and American religion? And her work is especially on Walmart and evangelical Christianity. But I think that this question is an important one because, you know, we try all these kinds of moral issues are intimately mixed in with issues of capitalism. How can we disentangle the moral impetus to you know, to care for the poor, to care for those who are less able. And I think that this is something that we do see as a possibility in certainly other kinds of capitalisms around the world. But I think that the real question for me is less about that than the faith in the market, that the very language, the religious language we have about mm-hmm. markets needs to be questioned. I, for one, don't think of markets as gods. I think of markets as means to an end, something that should help us achieve our ambitions and so far. I'm curious what Julia thinks.
If I could just add to that, yeah. I mean, yes, I wish Bethany was here with us because her wonderful book on Walmart does speak to this. And I think one of the important things that Bethany adds to this conversation is that, you know, it's not just this, you know, what's the matter with Kansas question about, you know, religion being co-opted or moral and religious concerns blinding working class people or middle class people to their like real, quote unquote, economic interests. But it's a matter of capitalism. Amazing ability to sort of appropriate, co-opt, but, you know, in some ways even accommodate, if that's not going too far, these kinds of concerns as well. So she finds at Walmart, for example, that, you know, the workplace culture of Walmart ironically, you know, takes into consideration and validates the sort of religious commitments and the ethical perspectives of its particularly pink collar labor. And then, you know, I'd also think about my work of my colleague Federico Finkelstein at the New School, who works on fascism in Latin America, and the way in which, as fascism and you know the kind of particular form of capitalism that is associated with it, you know, gains ground in Latin America in the post-war period, that it becomes very much you know the iconography and. Well, let's leave it at iconography of Catholicism in particular, you know, is something that is very important for understanding how that particular political economic system is accepted by, you know, the by people in Latin America.
You study this so much. Do you two worry about that happening here? Some of our listeners do. They're saying, you know, Walmart, other big companies, subsidiaries become, you know, as they become monopolies, they become almost official state providers. They're almost dictating policy, and the word that you use there for Latin America, you've got listeners bringing it up this way. That you know, fascism is such a potent word. I don't know, Lewis. Do you worry about corporatism, the power of corporations here? When you look at capitalism historically, is there a point at which it tips into something that's not producing those fruits you describe because of that power?
Yes, I mean, obviously, if corporations start to control our democracy, it's the end of democracy. I think we need to figure out what is the right balance between capitalism and democracy. This is the essential question. Now, I obviously don't want fascism to rise in America.
Yeah.
I love America,
yes.
You know,
yes.
And, you know, this is why I study it. But I think that it's certainly something to be afraid of. You know, a lot of the people on the left and the right have very millenarian instincts about capitalism, that they want it to crash or crumble or it's going to, you know, bring us into a sort of capitalist rapture. But I think we should be engaged with the here and now and not assume it's going to go to the next step or whatever that might mean, and really try to take a practical, sober look at how we bring about turning capitalism into an engine of prosperity for everyone, as we've done before.
Well, give us some thoughts on that. Let's say that you were, instead of the big three automakers sitting before a congressional inquiry, it was you. And let's say Congress was really thriving and functioning in a dynamic way and saying, look, let's think about how our capitalism has evolved, where it stands right now, if there are things we might do to help it be more beneficial for the whole country. What would you say to that congressional panel, Lewis?
Well, I think that, I mean, the first thing you notice is that Ford now has the best-selling car in the world, right? So that things change.
Ford Focus,
I think,
yes, they do.
Yeah, that's right. Yeah, things change. So capitalism changes, and that Microsoft doesn't seem quite the overpowering monopoly it once did, you know, just even 10 or 15 years ago.
Mm-hmm.
So I think to recognize that we need to find new kinds of technology and support the growth of technology. While we spend a lot of time talking about the 1%, we don't talk about that other 1%, which is the less than 1% of the federal budget that supports basically the NSF and the NIH, all the scientific research in America. And to me, this is a crazy situation because what makes capitalism—
That we're cutting that, you mean?
Yeah, exactly. Mm-hmm. What makes capitalism rejuvenate itself are new possibilities of technological investment. And this is what people in the 30s and 40s got, that it was about business and the state and researchers working together to create new industries, aerospace industry, electronics, right, all those things.
So research and rejuvenation, we get that link. Julia, our time begins to go quite short here. What about rejuvenation and making sure that we get it and that its fruits, you know, are widespread enough to keep everybody in the game?
Right. I mean, that needs to be part of the picture, too. And
what's your advice to Congress here?
My advice to Congress? Wow. I mean, it needs to be a thorough kind of examination of this issue, right? So, I mean, it can be everything from labor policy and raising the minimum wage and, building up our social safety net so that, the inevitable crises of life for the working poor and the working class and even the middle class, don't derail people and take them out of the workforce. To the great detriment of their economic circumstances. You were speaking specifically about the issue of inequality. There are all of those aspects. And, Lewis is, I think, very much correct about private capital being very timid. And if we want to also, and what we need to do is create good jobs that can support the working and middle classes, that the government policy should facilitate and incentivize private capital and sort of lead private capital into investments in new industries.
Listen, we are glad that you and your cohort are out there writing and thinking and talking about capitalism in new and dynamic ways. Clearly, we don't want to get ossified here, and there's a risk of that. Really grateful to both of you for joining us this hour. Julia Ott at the New School, author of When Wall Street Met Main Street. Stay on it, and thank you for joining us, Julia.
Thank you very much.
And Lewis Hyman at Cornell, author of Borrow and Debtor Nation. Lewis, thanks so much.
Anytime, Tom. Thanks so much.
Listeners, thanks for joining us. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point.